Hi Sandra, you asked me to speak about essentially speculation, the art of speculation, the skill of speculation, the principle of speculation, specifically the practice of speculation. The example which you referred to is, what do we know about extraterrestrials? And how do we perceive things like these? More specifically, how do our perceptions of the things that we do not know relate to the things that we think that we know? And of course that includes the question, how well do we know what we know? Because if we really knew what we knew, then why would we have to reconsider and rethink our thinking every now and then? You suggested that we take the pineal gland as the pivot in all of that, and in a way that's probably the most practical connection, because then we can sort of find out how our thinking connects to our brain, of which we still need to discover a lot, so we can only speculate about that. Then we also need to know better how our thoughts connect to our body, and medicine has very inconsistent and incomplete knowledge about that. They actually tend to deny or ignore the psychosomatic effects, with negative results, by the way. So we need to speculate some about that. We evidently need to somehow compare our experience in our mind and in our body to those in the minds and bodies of other people. Which of the two is confused, them or us? As the guy said, I just assume that other people are confused too. Which was a nice way of saying that we never know for sure what we think, what the other thinks, so we can only speculate about that. And specifically, if we then start to extend that idea of what we experience now to what has happened at other times, we do not yet know about the future, and we are no longer in the past, then what can we know about the past? We can only speculate about that too. So that's basically a fourfold speculation. So how can we pull some ideas to get a workable notion out of that? And perhaps the whole essence of this kind of speculation about speculation, in speculating about speculating, is precisely about that. Somehow we are able to speculate and thereby cover over the blind spots in our understanding and compensate for the ignorance that we by definition have individually and collectively, and to realize that whatever we know might be complemented or perhaps even compensated by what we don't know in the form of the knowledge of others. But then of course, if you stand face to face with somebody else, you see precisely the opposite of what they see. You see their dead skin cells and their reflexes based on behavior programmed in the long past. They see the same of you. Reflex behavior, dead and dying skin cells. And when you look down inside of you, you find uncertainty, doubts, and the possibilities of decisions of which you can only hope that somehow they might work out. While you can only assume that perhaps they're doing the same, but as you can see in politics and all kind of corporate systems, people know that they don't know within themselves, but when they interact with others, they sort of skip that whole notion that others too within themselves are uncertain. So it's like a right-angled kind of conversation that's vertically downward within them, from the pineal gland to the hypophysis, to the organ glands, to the body cells. They know that they don't know, and they know that they're creating a life and they're creating all kinds of choices and decisions leading to beliefs and behavior. But that they're actually just guessing while they go. And while they're doing that, they somehow are not always able to connect in that same scanning, exploring, puzzling, discovering process in the other. People actually seem to be able to need to be in love, to be able to get a kind of attunement of the internal process in the one and the internal process in the other. And that's of course where it's very interesting that you have some religions which say that you can actually only understand yourself and each other when you operate from that principle of love, that you operate from that understanding that within you, you don't know, within them, they don't know. And together you might know that you don't know, and in any case have some kind of stereo perspective on that, so that you can unfold an understanding. And then you can see if you can find words for what you feel, for the notions that you have, bring them to ideas and to thoughts, and then express them. And then out of that, see if you can come to some common understanding while you're still standing face to face, and you see a background behind them, while they see a background behind you, which are the total opposite of each other. So that in knowing that you will totally disagree about everything, because in a way you're looking at the opposite part of reality, both of you together, that somehow you can understand and trust that in combination those perspectives will complement each other and complete each other. So there is something of survival value in the art of being able to speculate, that you need to in a way be able to overcome the blind spots that we have, not just in our eyes but also in different levels of the psychology, different levels of the physiology. There's so many blind spots in our own functioning that people often ignore or deny that they're there. In that sense, while we sleep, we have a blind spot. When we think about one thing while in fact needing to think about the other, we are operating in a kind of blind spot. And in our body we can find that there are all kind of compensative mechanisms by which we can correct and fluff out and polish over those blind spots, as a result of which people might not even see that in their eye there is a part where they actually do not see, because that's where the retina is sort of plugged into the brain and the optic nerve bundle leaves the eye to bring the messages that have been harvested forth. So in our body we can see how physically the blind spot of the one eye compensates for the blind spot of the other, but that there is also this moving side by side tracking motion, which is called a saccadic motion, which sort of fuzzes the edges of the blind spot, so we can sort of partially fill it in and partially be able to ignore it. While in the brain it is evident that the image of the one eye is superimposed on the image of the other, as a result of which the blind spot in the one is sort of half translucent versus the blind spot of the other eye, which is in a different spot, so they don't overlap, they don't reinforce each other. And then in the comparison of the image that you have with images from the past, you can then see how the image of the present might be filled in by experiences projected as expectations from the past. And that's where most people really go blind, when they replace their perceptions by projections and are no longer able to see what is. And actually in psychiatry that is called a lack of reality testing, that what they project they can no longer discern from what they perceive. That principle operates in our body in many ways, many levels, so it's very crucial, very important. It not only works in our body, but it also works in our mind. It also works in our communications. It also works in society and thus in humanity. So it's really important to understand that. And the core of that whole principle of the blind spot in the eye can be symbolically and practically understood in effect in the pineal gland, which is also known as the third eye. The pineal gland described as a kind of eye without a socket, with optical tissue so it can detect light, sitting in the middle of the brain, which allegedly or supposedly is dark, but nevertheless, just like the muscles and the heart and the cells of the body, it's all filled with this electricity of messages, information, currents, circulations, so that the pineal gland might be physically in the dark, but still it is in an electromagnetic field in which the neurons and the hormones play a part, and that electromagnetic field of course contains the light field. So in that sense, what we see with our eyes is only a part of the electromagnetic field, and the pineal gland in our brain is then at the center of that perception of the brain, which actually comes from the sensory cells, which are points scattered over the surface of the body, connected by neurons going inward. These neurons then combine in the plexus, the tapestries or interwoven neurons, and then go into the brain. So that's a four-stage translation from a point to a line to a plane to a volume. So the brain is this living colony of cells. It's one organ combined with all of the other organs. There is a kind of mirroring of the brain in the head versus what happens in the body. So our head is, say, permanently separated from the body by the neck. And what happens in the brain is like the complement of what happens in the body. And when you look at the neural or the nervous structure of the head, you can see that the bundles cross from left to right. So in a way you could see it is as if some invisible hand has pulled something from the core of the body and then turned it inside out, as a result of which left and right are swapped, and putting it outside of the body on where we see it as the brain. And so we have, like the snail, eyes on stilts, so that we can look beyond our body, and that the information processing in our brain is further away from our body. This in a way gives us a bit of an advantage in being looking out over the environment and sort of be able to see further and detect earlier, and thereby guide the body better in what the body can do. So the brain is in that sense the complement of all of the organs in the body, and as the Indian and Chinese and spiritual forms of healthcare describe, those organs together are one organ system. They are actually considered to be one organ in which, let's say, all of our musical notes in the octave, or another way of describing the same is that they're all the gods of the Olympus. They're all elements of a circle of blood circulation, but also of information circulation. So once you understand that all the organs are connected and together form one organ, then it is easy to understand that the brain is the counterpart of that whole system, and in its way is then the Olympus, of which the organs would be then the gods. And that in the brain you have that information field in which the pineal gland, our third eye, is a scanning, say, microphone or the joystick, which is positioned between the forebrain and the hind brain, and that is then considered to be the tip of the pyramid of our perception, in which on the one hand the rear brain has the information field, which is electromagnetic, with the soup of chemistry around it provided by cells which make it all tangible, but yet in essence it is the information field of everything that happens inside of the body. The forebrain is then the counterpart of that. It has the information of everything that happens on the surface of the body. So the pineal gland then compares that. And it not just compares the forebrain with the hindbrain, that is what's on the surface, with what's inside of the body, but it is connected to the hypophysis, which has the neuronal side for the animal behavior and the hormonal side for the vegetative behavior. So the animal and the plant come together, fight and flight on the one side, fear and faint on the other. And then this pineal gland as a joystick operates in the light field, in the electromagnetic spectrum, and then relays its perception of front and back, or inside and outside, what's happening in the body, and in the hypophysis then connects it to this electromagnetic polarization capacity, which is the nature of our ability to make a decision with a response to the outside world, corresponding to the front brain, or with a response towards the internal world, corresponding with the hind brain. And in the outside world, the neurons are able to put things in actions like the animals would do. In the hind brain, the hormonal side of the hypophysis will then be able to turn it into a chemical change within the body, an internal adaptation. So that's what we see there. The external adaptations like animals do, or the internal adaptations like plants do. And from then on, it's just a matter of chemistry. It goes into the organ glands, which are a spectrum known as the rainbow bridge. It's also known as the chakra system. Basically, these are the glands of the organs, and in that sense, the regulators and controllers of those organs, or the effect of those organs into the body. So in that sense, they are the messenger of the organs, thus the gods of the Olympus have their messenger, which generally is called Mercury, and that of course is then fed into the blood and circulates around, which is the winged travels of Mercury, as a result of which everything in the body is orchestrated to correspond to what the third eye has chosen to experience in connecting more to the outside world or connecting more to the inside world. The decision which was taken there at the electromagnetic level then turns into a kind of change of climate or change of temperature of the internal climate of the chemistry of the body, the body chemistry, the whole organ system, which then creates an internal state in the body which we call our belief system. And that relates to the experience of our body, and of course also how the cells in our body relate to that experience and how they can or will act on that. An important step in that transition is that from the pineal gland to the hypophysis, with that electrical decision taking, at that time around there is also this inclusion of the past, where memory comes in. So where earlier I was speaking about the decisions that we take are in respect to the past, then actually that past experience is not in the world around us and not of the world around us, but merely in that region of the brain around that decision-taking center where we need to decide, are we going to include ourselves in the environment or do we need to temporarily exclude ourselves from the environment? In a way, do we wake up to what happens around us, or are we going to fall asleep within what's going around us? And in the organ system, that is then seen as the four seasons of our adaptation. The waking up is the summer coming in, or the sun coming out on dawn, and the going to sleep is the sun going under at night, or the winter being in a more darkened space, more colder space as well. So in that setting, we then navigate between being involved or not involved, which is also known as heaven or hell. Heaven is where everything connects. Hell is where you decide to disconnect yourself from the environment, because hell is that old English term from the concept of helling off, which means to isolate, to separate, and as I've mentioned other times as well, the French use exactly the same notion. They call it enfer, from enfermer, which is to isolate, to separate. So you can choose to go into your separate experience. You go back in the egg, you go in back in a hibernation mode, you go into a mode of apathy, you go back into being a baby. You basically have no notion of what you can do or what you will do in the environment that you're in. That's called the vegetative or apathic state of being. That's called the cellular state of being. And then from the cellular, you can go to the plant level, to the animal level, to the human level. You could also say that's a transition from winter to spring, to summer, and then with the reversal of that again in autumn. So there is a cycle of the seasons, and all forms of traditional healthcare are very much aware of that. That this is not just a state of the seasons around us, but also the dynamic of the cell cycle, which operates in exactly the same manner, the day and night cycle of our metabolic system, the aging cycle in our life, and so many other cycles within us, which are then described by chronobiology and other kind of understanding. I need to refer to that because once you realize that we are always operating in this difference between day and night, and like in our breathing, we breathe in and connect, and we breathe out and sort of express. It is again that relation between perception and projection. It is between those two that we find the balance of how you want to position yourself in the reality that you're in. And of course, when you breathe out, somebody else will breathe that in, and in that way we're all connected. So we need to somehow understand that when from the pineal gland, which is, as you said, Sandra, also called the sun or the eye of Ra, or there's so many ways to describe this pivot of our decision taking in our being, in life and in creation. That's not just the taking of the decision, but how do you connect that decision to what you're going to do with it? The choice in the pineal gland and the decision one level down in the electromagnetic relates to what you know. How you can then say that it's not just a relationship of what you know, what you have in your memory at that moment, but also what you have in your body memory from the whole time that you lived, which includes all your unconscious memories. But it also includes all of the ancestral memories, which are, let's say, programmed into your DNA. So once you start to connect it to the memories in your body, the ones that you remember that you have, the ones that you do not remember that you have, and the ones you might not even know that you have, then that's the kind of level in which we take our decision. So talking about the speculation of how we then make clarity in our understanding, then it becomes evident that you actually know a lot more than you know, because you not only have the memories that you can access, but you also have those hidden memories, which in a sleep state or a dream state, it's called hypnosis, you may recall. And actually, it is very good practice to keep them alive and to look at them now and then, which is also part of the old mystery school training. But then it's also important to realize that you also embody within yourself your ancestral memories, some of the primordial decisions of scary things that they lived through and actually survived are then charged into your DNA and become part of the response patterns that not only build your body but also build your mind and say the soul of the body, that what the body can do. So that memory is what we work with within us, and it is evident that in that same way, just as we have the cell communication between us on which we base the decisions and the thoughts and the actions and interactions that we engage in, and likewise between us, the communication between people reflects what happens within us. So when we interact with other people, and there too we have that equivalent of the memories which are actual in the culture at that present, which is the kind of things that people talk about, and if you want to have a simple expression of it, it's the kind of conversation which you can find in the barber shop, which is now called the news service. It is the kind of gossip of what people are doing, and the attempt to get some clarity of it and to learn from it so that in the future we can do that better and maybe even prevent some of those problems. So in our cultural living memory, we have that part of, say, current knowledge, the news and the media service, which has been highly tainted and is very distorted at the moment. But nevertheless, it needs to function at that level. And so in your environment, that is actually the only kind of stuff that you can then use as the kind of active memory of the culture. Likewise, there is of course also the hidden memory of the culture, like we have the hidden memory within us. And in our culture, we know that as the archive of written records, which is not just all the stuff on paper, but also the paintings people make, the music that we still know, the stories that are still being told, as some of the research of the Indians in North America showed, how those stories can be 10,000 years old. And of course we also have the architecture and landscape sculpturing, which are part of that ongoing, but maybe somewhat hidden, memory of the history of humanity. There is a still deeper level, just like we have the DNA, we have natural laws in the environment around us, so that in nature we can see how the water evaporating from the ocean created visible and invisible streams of water in the air, which we call clouds, which then can lead to mist or to rain or to snow or to hail coming down, carving rivers in the landscape. And so those carvings in the landscape are also part of the memory of the world around us. And they're not just in the landscape, but they're also inbuilt in our body. So when we try to look into the hidden history of humanity, we find that there are the oral records, the memories as they have been told from one generation to the other. And yes, there are examples that for 10,000 years that can be very accurate. So if that happens in one case, there will be more cases where that is taking place. We also know that some people are liars. They will actually tell something which is not so. They will actually intentionally distort stories, or they pull stories out of context. So in our cultural setting, we will have stories which are intentional or unintentional distortions of what really happened. So there are a lot of tales in history which are actually inaccurate reports of what took place. And sometimes it's because people weren't there and forgot, or people don't remember well, or people intentionally do not tell the proper story, or they just never understood what was taking place anyways. So when we look at the stories of history, we have great difficulty to understand what was going on, even if you look at books which have been written thousands of years ago, then there might be great difficulty of understanding what really happened for a couple of reasons. First of all, was it a truthful account, or was it an intentionally or non-intentionally distorted account? Did the writer actually understand what was going on? Or was it a lack of understanding right from the start when the story was written? Maybe it wasn't based on truth at all, but it was just fiction as a kind of mind exercise, as so many religions and so many psychotherapists use of, okay, now think about this differently. What would happen if, and then you get this whole genre of novels and fiction and science fiction and other kind of imaginary tales, which somehow will still connect to our brain or our capacity to thinking, but they will be like a drug or like sugar. They will be stimulating, but not actually nourishing. So they activate the process of the mind, but they do not connect to anything in reality. And that's where you then have the same kind of principle as the psychiatrist test for. It's called the reality testing. What you see, is that an actual experience, or is it an imagination? Is it the projection, or is it the perception? That image that you have of reality, and that this image that you have of you, the world image and the self image, are they compatible and mutually computable? Or are both of them, or one of them, erroneous? Are they fictions? Are they superstitions? Are they just basically very much wrong? So all of this comes in place not only in the connection between perception and projection, the learning about the world, or the replay of what you know about the world in the decision-taking process by which we relate to the world around us, but we have the same going on in the stories of the past. For example, let's take the cultural handbook as it was intended to be used and has become very much abused, which is the story of the Bible. There are many people who tell each other that this is actually how it was. It is a truthful historical record, and the author needs to be trusted fully. That is an interesting thought, and if you follow that thought, you will read that book in a very specific manner, and you will give it a meaning which for you might be very precise, but is that actually what the authors also intended? Were the authors actually able to describe what they meant? Were they accurate in their descriptions in time and place, and in what people supposedly said? Was it a journalistic record of what happened at that moment? Was it a diary statement of an experience of somebody who had just lived at the moment before? Or was it just something hearsay coming from somebody else, somebody very much later? Now, if you just look around in the world that you know, how many sayings are attributed to, for example, Albert Einstein? Did he actually say any of that? Or, in a different way, when you write your diary and you try to formulate what happened that day, are you able to actually describe the complexity and sometimes the absolute sudden switches and turns in the event that happen in such a way that others could know and understand what's taking place? Once you keep a diary, you will notice that you cannot actually describe what's happening. From the point of view of system theory, you cannot even you can even say explicitly that the map is not a territory. The model is not reality. Realization and reality operate in very different dimensions. So when we look at the books of history, we need to acknowledge the same, that the book is not a reality, that the description is not the truth, and maybe it will be helpful so that you cannot use a literal interpretation of the book, but you can sort of grasp or grope for what people might have meant with it. So when people talk about events in the biblical past, for example, they say that Moses came from Egypt and basically fled the country. Do you then also understand that Moses was the vicar of Akhenaten, who had just been done quite a intellectual feat, a transformation of the intellectual basis of the culture by going from polytheism to monotheism? That's generally where the whole notion of monotheism came from. But also it was as if people went from the many god views, which nowadays we would call the atomic table of elements, to the monoatomic quantum view, which we would now call the quantum. So at that time, there was a sudden shift where, let's say, that the scientists of the time, called the priests of that time, were still working with that model of the different atoms of reality, as they would consider them. And then suddenly there's this guy, Akhenaten, who says that essentially there is something very different going on, which is much more fundamental. Let's call it a quantum, or if you consider Planck's quantum, it is sort of directly connected to Einstein's photon, the quantum being the switch in the light wave and the photon being the wave of the light wave. You can sort of bridge the gap of understanding right there at that level once you really get into the image of what these people were looking at. So something like that happens in the past as well. So once you understand that, this, let's say, Hebraic past of the Bible is actually Egyptian, then you are aware that the context in which that book was read needs to be translated and transcribed all the way. And this is very much like the transposition of a musical piece which was from one note and needs to be rewritten totally because it needs to go into a different note. That is also what is done in the University of Good Books, where people learn to experience that and to process that. The St. John's University actually is based on a curriculum of reading books of seven different cultures, seven different time zones, seven different languages, seven different mindsets, so that you can actually experience that the words that were written need to be understood in the absence of telephones, in the absence of cars, in the absence of fresh food, in the situation of cold winters because the heating was not there. And so when you read the book, you need to actually mentally and psychologically reset your sensory system to go from the one culture into the other. And just as reading a book about the hardship of people traveling in the tundra in the winter is meaningless when you're sitting at the beach in summer sipping something juicy, and then likewise you cannot have the right understanding of a book, be it the Bible or anything else, if you are not aware of the setting and the circumstances that it writes in and writes from. So when you realize that in the pineal gland we need to balance the inside and the outside, and that in our body we actually need to process that decision from the pineal gland, which is in the light field, to the hypophysis, which is electromagnetic, to the organ glands, which are chemical, to the cells, which then act on it in a physical sense, that likewise when we do that outside of our body and we are not dealing with our own memory, actual memory, hidden memory, or ancestral memory in the DNA, but we're doing that in the context of the culture, then we see that we can understand the parallels in how the active memory and the hidden memory and the long-term memory of the culture is chronicled, but we still will need to translate that kind of memory from the past into what we can use in the present. So when you have that kind of gaps to fill, coming back to the notion of the blind spot described before, then you are aware that these blind spots in our body correspond with blind spots in history, which go very far, very deep. So we do have a difficulty in understanding how these people actually lived, and we do actually have a misunderstanding of what these people knew. Let me just refer to this book, We Are Not the First, which is a collection of archaeological findings, which basically put together the notion that the people in the past were not as stupid as people nowadays like to believe. There's a kind of cultural lie or a cultural self-deception. I call that normalization. It is the idea that what you hold to be true, what you are thinking, is correct and valid. But it's only later that you can see that that's not true. We can see that in science. Over the past centuries, every moment science said, this is like this, scientifically proven, scientific discovery, the total newness. We now know for sure, and you come back 100 years later, or 50 years later, 10 years later, or maybe 5 days later, and it turns out that that was not so. It was a way of looking at things and a way of seeing things which seemed to be logical at that time, but actually, if you look at it in a larger context and from a larger perspective, then it turns out that more things play a role, and actually you cannot look at that only in that manner. So in science it went from looking at matters to looking at molecules to looking at atoms, and now they're still trying to understand what happens at the quantum level. Fortunately, tetrionics gives a new kind of insight which knits it all together. But those kind of ideas that we now know what we know is not that accurate, certainly not that precise, and actually we cannot trust that, because there might be things that you have forgotten which a moment later you remember, and then you realize you need to think about things differently. We do that individually, and we also do that collectively. So that book, We Are Not the First, shows that lights have been found in temples which had not been opened for thousands of years, and the light was still burning. When they opened it up and opened up the lamp, the light went out and they could never work out what really happened. The book is filled with examples of things which are, let's say, anachronistic, which supposedly were not possible at that time, but yet that is where they were found. Machined pieces of iron embedded in rock, the debris of nuclear fallout in deserts from thousands of years ago, stories and pictures of flying machines described in India and depicted in temples in Egypt long before, according to our history, these devices were invented. So we must always allow for knowledge that we do not know about anymore, and we cannot judge on basis of the knowledge that we have. We must in some way be able to extend that knowledge and our understanding. And that's what people have been trying to do for a very long time. They have been trying to fill in our gaps of knowledge, or they have been trying to remember and memorize previous existing knowledge, but just as the individual describing the diary might have difficulty to really describing what's going on. Likewise, the people describing the knowledge that they had could only describe it in the terms that they have of the understanding that they have. So their language, when an Egyptologist starts to decode Egyptian hieroglyphics and thinks in terms of people eating, living, having sex, doing something else, then there will not be an inclusive idea of perhaps these people already understanding quantum physics or maybe even unified field physics. And as a result, out comes the story that the pyramid must be a graveyard for somebody important, instead of realizing that it could equally well be a geo vibration and cosmic vibration driven resonator with two layers of rock, so that the piezoelectric effect will actually interact with each other in the same way as the Japanese garden have the basalt rock next to the calcium rock, so the volcanic rock plus the sediment rock, as a result of which the electromagnetic field can unfold, which has different qualities for the plants in the region around it. And that in the pyramid they use the same, plus also pipelines in the pyramid, which, as Christopher Dunn said, are actually the equivalent of a Helmholtz resonator, so that it is like a kind of flute in which you can tune the kind of notes that will resonate in that building while this building is being charged up by the rumblings of the earth and the light of the stars and the ionosphere. So as long as an archaeologist or so-called Egyptologist doesn't understand that there might be more things to think of, then they will not be able to understand that. And then of course there will be difficulties in relating the stories which are described in that kind of historical records. For example, in Flanders Field in England, there is this tomb of King Seti I, which actually portrays amphorae neatly piled up on the one side, snakes going along the amphorae, crossing over a wall, and then on the other side there is a picture of somebody lying on the bed with a kind of parabola overhead, with a snake coming from the parabola to the forehead of the person lying there. And the text which corresponds with that picture is then called the Book of the Opening of the Gates. But what would somebody make of that when he actually thinks that snakes would be snakes? First you have a basement with jars of wine or something, maybe oil, with snakes crawling all over the place. And then on the other side of the wall, snakes can actually go from the one side of the wall to the other. And then off something hanging on the ceiling, would it be a lamp or would it be something? There's this snake jumping at the forehead of the man. Yes, you will come to a different kind of understanding than when you have read that book of We Are Not the First and other books of that kind of historical discovery, in which you know that the amphorae represent batteries and that the snakes are actually electrical conductors, and that those are not snakes crawling about, but cables with electricity, with live electricity, going from the one room to the other, and that there's actually a parabola antenna in which a beam of radiative energy is directed to the forehead of the individual, which is the pineal gland, which is precisely that spot where the inside world and the outside world, the surface of the body and the core of the body, are balanced with respect to each other. So what do we know of the capacity to use specific frequencies or pulses or some kind of electromagnetic information signal that will stimulate the pineal gland in such a manner that you can actually perceive beyond the reality that you're in. There are many people who have the notion of being able to perceive more than what you can see with your physical eyes. And there are many books which actually say that if you want to see the unseen, you need to close your eyes. The myth of Odin is about that, Odin is depicted with a raven on his shoulder, because the story says that he needed to learn to go blind for the world around him so that he could see the inner world. And then he is depicted as having one eye, which is actually the representation of the third eye, in combination to the capacity to blind himself for the world around us, which actually is what you would call meditation. If you want to see the unseen, then you need to close your eyes and you need to turn on that internal imagination capacity in the brain, which not only can access your memories, your hidden memories, which is what hypnosis can bring forth, but also your ancestral memories, which rebirthing and other techniques can bring forth, but that you can also go around that and beyond that, because all of the electrical fields in your body are also a radio field, which means it is not limited to your body at all. And as Phil Callanan said, in our brain we can encompass the 11 centimeter wave band, which actually spans the whole earth, which means that all our brains are telepathically connected if we can only tune into it. But if you're mesmerized and engrossed and involved in the outer world only, then how can you switch to looking on the internal world only? And yes, then you have these schools in the Himalaya, Tibet, and other places, the Andes, where you can actually sit in the dark. And there is the Kogi Indians, where in their first years they actually live in the dark and being fed, so that they actually learn to turn on that internal vision. Just as Ananda took people into the caves in Norway, said that they could sit in the dark and after a couple of days discover that they can actually see in the total darkness, that there's not a capacity of seeing which we have, are capable of, but which you can only turn on once you stop looking at the world around you. So once you realize that we have an external vision but also an internal vision, that the internal vision is not only what we can see around us, or in our memories, or in our remote memories, but also in our shared memories, then the picture becomes quite different. And then come up the stories of the visionaries and the seers, who are able to connect thoughts of them and the others, let's call it telepathy, like Phil Callahan described, and that they can unite their vision with that of others. Let's consider ourselves as a mobile phone, and when we can plug them all into all other people in humanity, let's call that God phone or the terminal of the system, then you can share your thoughts with everybody else. And of course, everybody else is quite an impressive God-like divine being then, because it seems to have all of the answers. And it's not just all of the people of humanity whose ideas you can then access and address like a terminal of a computer, but you can also in the same way connect to all other life forms who also have their experiences and memories. So with that kind of understanding, the stories of the Egyptians need to be regarded in a different kind of light. And there are many researchers who have realized that in antiquity, people knew a lot more than under the influence of dogmatization of this principle of normalitis. That people insist that they're the best, they might even be better than others, which of course is incomplete understanding, and that in that sense, not the stories of the Egyptians are very different if you understand that they might have a stellar technology of information field direction for which they used the pyramids. And in the same way that they had pyramids in other continents, which might all be connected and be used as radio devices connecting between all the cultures. as Constantine Meil also describes. And with that kind of understanding, it would be folly to say that when the Greeks represent Zeus as having a bolt of lightning in his hand, this is a kind of fiction or superstition, because if you really look at Zeus, which is then, say, the primordial or the, the integrated human, then that bolt of lightning, on the one hand, represents the mastery and understanding of electricity, with all that it contains in what we understand now by the laws of Maxwell, and that would be the original formulation of the laws of Maxwell in the quaternion notation, which includes the Tesla waves and the Hertz waves in precisely the way that Tetrionics now describes, so that these people already understood electricity. But in another way, you can also understand that that lightning bolt in his hand is actually also related to our DNA, because by biology or astrobiology, the hypothesis at the moment is that a charge discharge in the primordial earth can fuse gases to a kind of lightning rod in the wake of the lightning into a structure that we call the amino acid. And like Gaston Nassens describes for the relationship between the somatite, the fungus, the virus, and the microbes, you can also see that there is a relationship between the amino acid, the protein, RNA, and DNA, that these fragments of amino acids are able to extend themselves, and that this lightning rod created out of a charge discharge in primordial earth is actually at the core of our cell as a kind of driving force to continue that development of extending a physicalization of this electrical effect of the charge discharge. And then the lightning bolt in the hand of Zeus would also be the DNA in association with that mastery of electricity and the conversion between information and energy. And that, of course, goes much deeper than the Einstein theories of energy being connected to the speed of light. And that is a limitation of energy. But once you see it's space and time and energy are connected as part of a larger story of information, which goes beyond the field of energy as the field of consciousness or the Akashic field, then suddenly the story turns inside out on itself, and within you, you literally are the inverse of the universe, as you can see in the cell, which is the universe in inverse, turned outside in. So once you have that kind of understanding, and you realize that we would not be the first, as the title of the book shows, and that we need to understand our own understanding and get beyond our blind spot and our inherent limitations, as I described in that blind spot story and the principle of normalitis, then somehow you need to come to understand that things are different, and that the stories that we are told and the stories that are being presented need to possibly be understood in a different manner also. So was the Bible actually written by the mistress of Tiberius Flavius in a way to sort of do a psychological warfare on the Hebraic people, because the Romans discovered that they could not actually control those, so they evicted them from their own country. The Hebraic people, what were the Hebraic people actually residents of that country, or were they just inwalkers from elsewhere? And yes, they came from Babylon because they had been taken there and sort of put out of there again. But by the earlier story, they came from Egypt and thus originally were Egyptians. So that story too needs to be reconsidered and looked at in a different manner. So all of the stories we need to look at in a different manner. So all of the stories of history we need to look at in a different manner. So when the people describe the gods of antiquity, do they actually mean gods, or are they talking about universal principles of creation, just as scientists and physicists would now call them laws of nature? In Italian, principe and principe, the principle or the prince, is the same. But the prince of the Bible, is that just the principle of creation? Probably yes. It's not just simply because by Occam's razor that would be the most simplistic and most explanatory common denominator of everything, but also would take it outside of a social context, of cultural context and historical context, into a context of much deeper meaning, which is something which you would expect to be the purpose of a book which has been aimed to integrate the understanding of all people. Of course, you cannot integrate the understanding of all people if you look at what people individually understand. In some way, you need to be able to address what we understand collectively, or even how our understanding is formed and where our understanding comes from. And that's where we have this nice connection to the Dogon story, which Laird Scranton has described on the basis of the information of anthropologists, which first described the Dogon and mentioned that there was this tribe which in Africa nowadays had this description of Sirius being a double star with a 50-year cycle, which is something which was discovered later in the astrophysical departments. But how to go about the other part of that Dogon story, in which they address an understanding of the origination of the universe, of the creation of matter in the universe, in the creation of the matter of life, the molecules of life in this universe, but also the origination of social organization, which means the integration of consciousness in matter, in organisms and in societies. Laird Scranton has looked at that, and as a computer transcoder, he was used to looking at different languages which you cannot translate from the one to the other, but where you can, if you know both languages, come to an understanding of what is being said in the language and come to express that in the other language. There are very many examples where one language has a word which the other language does not. It's like a molecule in which there is an atom which the other molecule doesn't have. So there is a deeper level of understanding, let's call it the quantum field, in which you can go beyond the understanding of the molecular level of understanding of language to the atomic level of understanding of language. What is the meaning? But at the deepest level, the quantum level, is how is it in connection to you? How that language, or how does that communication in that language help you to make a better decision in how you relate to yourself, to life, to other people, and to the planet? So at that level then, Laird Scranton understood that this text of the Dogons was actually very much similar to the formulation of superstring theory in the different variations of it, and that the Dogon were actually more detailed in their description of the core of superstring theory than superstring theory as yet has defined. So there you get the question, how does that relate to our understanding if the Dogon, 40,000 years or much more before, already had that knowledge which from the Dogon has then been transmitted to Egypt and to Syria and between them to the Hebrews, and from them the Judeo-Christian cultures of the world. So we must always understand that the Western world is originally not Muslim and not Christian and not Jewish or Hebraic, but Babylonian and Egyptian, but then by what Laird Scranton and others described, how that actually came out of Africa, and the Dogon is then the much deeper root of it all. What to do then with the understanding that the Dogon described, that they actually got their people, their information from people who came from off Earth and who landed on Earth and then put things in a perspective here, brought some insight, brought some understanding, brought some techniques and technology, and as other texts describe, they also engaged humans in their activities, and as it is rumored, they also did some genetic modulation of humans. I call it crossbreeding, in the way that the Egyptians were doing that, in the same way that the bulb growers in different countries use strands which are closely related to very selectively go for a color and a shape and a form. Likewise, the Egyptians were looking for specific traits in consciousness, awareness, and body physiology, and thus anatomy. And in that same way, those stories go that those off-earthers interacted with the humans, crossbred with them, and as Sommer's book said, the gods took a liking to the women of Earth and mated with them. That's a kind of cross-fertilization or cross-breeding, which then is at the basis of a lot of those stories about ETs, but also stories of different religions, stories of different cultures. But in a larger perspective, it is on the one hand, let's say, a rape of a species by another species, but in another way, it's not other than a sexual encounter between two different species, as you would have between two different people. As you are aware, our present culture has a lot of difficulty of understanding, appreciating, and really respecting sexual interactions, as you can see from a lot of misunderstandings about pornography, sexuality, sexual regulations, and the still existing sexual violence. And if you could bring that back to sexual respect, then of course the difference between male and female is not a difference at all, but a complementarity, a completeness. And then you can see that the male and the female are both half of the story, and in their union, like the left loudspeaker speaker and the right loudspeaker of a stereo system, can bring out the wholeness of the sound and the space between the loudspeakers, where you can actually walk between the instruments of the orchestra. And it is that kind of understanding, like seeing in the dark and learning to see beyond our own seeing, that there are many ways in which we can overcome our own limitations, those of the body and those of the mind, by interacting with each other and learning from each other. And in that, we have a lot of stories from history, and as they say, that's always different from her story. So we need to integrate those stories of history in her story and see that throughout the cultures there are different, often limited perspectives what might have happened, but those are interpreted in a limiting and often crippling manner by not understanding how those people lived and what those people actually knew. So once you start to look into history, there are a lot of things that you need to reconsider, because there might have been things going on which is quite different from the way that they are interpreted. Look, for example, of the people who show that there are images of men in orbs flying around in the sky, drawn, painted in the Middle Ages. And likewise, text in older cultures which describe such flying machineries. That we should not impose our limitations on descriptions of others. Simply not understanding the others does not mean that the other is wrong. And the Western culture has this horrible tendency of denying and even decimating people who have a different opinion or a different experience or a different understanding. Look at all the tribes which have basically been bluntly killed by Westerners because those cultures had a different story than that of the priests or the politicians were trying to propagate in the different cultures. Cultural rape has been going on for a very long time, but rape is very different from sexual interaction, sexual intercourse, and sexual enlightenment. And the Western culture still has to wake up of that, not just the sexuality, but also the relevance of the knowledge being able much larger than what we can physically know and see. So the theme of the story, which I wish to present now, is that we must be able to overcome the limitations of the blind spot in how we look at things. We must be able to overcome the limitations in our own conditioning and self-hypnosis, by which we hold something to be true at the exclusion of everything else. And we must overcome and transcend the cultural bias that what we together talk about with each other would be right, because essentially that's just another form of self-hypnosis. And how is that different from what you see in the day and what you could see at the night? And the knowledge of what the scientist looks at and what the artists say what we can look at. So we need to expand our understanding and come to a larger perspective, which you can only do within yourself by realizing that whatever you hold to be true might be different. And then, of course, if you look at the stories of the past, you start to look at it with different eyes, not just how you would read it, but how would they write it. But also, when they wrote it, how were they limited by language and cultural context of what they actually wanted to write? And what they wanted to write was basically always about something that they were learning, something that they thought was very important, something that they didn't quite grasp yet, or thought that they grasped as a process of development which was still ongoing. So that whatever they were trying to understand, they were still trying to work that out, they still tried to find words for it, they still tried to communicate it in a way that others could understand it. And the question is then, do you understand all of that when you read that? So the stories of history, the stories of the heroes of the past, the stories of the gods of the past, the stories of the extraterrestrials in the past, all of them are explorations of trying to get to know what we don't know yet, or what we might even have forgotten. Does that mean that the gods were extraterrestrials? Does that mean that the extraterrestrials were gods? Does that mean that the heroes were half gods, and in that sense maybe half extraterrestrials? In any case, there is an understanding that there was a cultural barrier or a cultural transition that needed to be resolved. And from the descriptions, we might not be able to see if this is about heroes or gods or extraterrestrials. But once we can identify that it is about something like that, then your mind is open to see in how many countries are the description of extraterrestrials. In how many countries are the descriptions that gods were human? And how many cultures are the descriptions that the gods met the humans? And when you go and see an expert on a topic, does that make that expert a godlike person? Or is that expert just a priest in a conditioning or a training of an understanding of that god, which is actually, let's say, the physicist who has studied physics, or the chemist who has studied chemistry? So should we call the physicist and the chemist, should we call them priest? And should we call the temple of physics or the temple of chemistry, which are now faculties in a university, should we call them the temples of the god of physics or the god of chemistry? Or can we understand that in the past those gods were likewise disciplines of a university, where later on the words of God have been simply mistranslated, because the Egyptians, the Greeks and the Romans were understanding something about universal principles which got pollinated or polluted by a different notion, which is that of political suppression and enslavement and slavery. So you need to actually be able to disentangle that to be able to read those texts. And then, yes, you might find that there are lots of texts about extraterrestrials. You might find that there are lots of texts about what those extraterrestrials brought to Earth and how they integrated with the people or not, as always, on the basis of respect or the basis of denial, in the same way that humanity is very much convoluted and contorted by a lack of respect of other people, simply being different, because when you're face to face, you see what's behind them and they see what's behind you. You cannot see what's behind you, they cannot see behind what's behind them. So you just need to trust each other. Then when you describe things were totally opposite, that both of them might be right. And that then is essentially this part of the story, that you will have opposite perspectives of things for the simple reason that the pineal gland is in the middle of that whole experience of the discrepancy between what's on the surface of the body and what's in the core of the body. And once you have that appreciation of the complementarity of that and the other, then you can also see, just as in mathematics, what's on the side, one side of the equation sign is the opposite of what happens on the other side of the equation sign. If you want to turn it into its opposite, all you have to do is you move the equation sign across that what seems to be negative on the one side, and you'll discover that's positive on the other side. But that equation sign is your involvement, your act and your art of involvement, in which you shift the frontier, you shift the boundary of what you include or exclude in your perceptions. And once you become aware of that, then you can see that the pineal gland is actually that equation sign within us, that the inside and the outside are actually complementary aspects of each other, because the cell is the inverse of the universe. And every cell division, every cell multiplication, is that process of the inversion of the cell. So you get the inverse of the inverse. So when one cell divides and two cells come out of it, they are opposites of each other. Should you call the one God and the other the devil, because they're complementary opposites? Because that's what biblical interpretation is. You have God and you have the antagonist. But in the muscle we call it agonist and antagonist. So why should we not just say God and devil are agonist and antagonist? And that on the equation sign, on the one side is plus, on the other side is minus. You will only understand it if you look at the equation at the whole, with the equation side in the middle, which is you, which is your pineal gland, which is your cell in its in unique position in the universe, and that from there you will have to somehow choose how you want to relate by negotiating the difference between what happens on the inside and what happens on the outside. That is essentially the story of creation. That's the creation of all stories. And once you get in touch with that, then the act of creation turns into art of creation. And I'd like to conclude the story with that.